The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says resistance group will remain vigilant until maritime deal with Israel is officially announced. Iran once again calls for peaceful settlement of differences between Armenia and Azerbaijan, saying it is opposed to any changes in international borders in the region. And the U.S. says that it is speeding up the delivery of sophisticated air defense systems to Ukraine following a recent missile barrage from Russia. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News. Now, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says that the resistance movement will stand by the government in its decision on a maritime deal with Israel.
We will remain vigilant until the government officially announces the deal has been signed. I know all the Lebanese people want this issue to end, but we need to keep vigilant since the other side might change their mind any moment.
Nasrallah once again warned the Israeli regime against looting Lebanon's natural resources. Lebanon's President Meshaoun had earlier said he will hold consultations with political groups for a unified position before giving a go-ahead to a final deal. The potential agreement with Israel seeks to settle Beirut's maritime dispute with the regime over a gas field in the East Mediterranean. Earlier, the presidential office said that the draft meets Lebanon's demands and protects its rights to natural wealth. It said that the agreement will pave the way for Lebanon to explore offshore natural gas reserves. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, recounts why the deal is so significant for Lebanon, adding it's the first time Israel has succumbed to the demands of an Arab state.
We have three main issues here. Number one is that we have a deal. It's been very discreet, of course, but we know some details. We know that Lebanon will be given definitely 923, and Lebanon will also be given a potentially rich field called the Kana field, which goes beyond line 23. It's not just line 23, so we have something line 23 plus. In addition to that, we have assigned a confirmation from the United States that Lebanon may begin immediately to drill in its waters, and no one will come near that right, and no one will stop that right. So these are three very significant issues that we do know from sources, of course. This has been translated by a meeting today between Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the Energy Minister Fayyad, who met with representatives of the French petroleum company Total, and they have asked the company to begin directly to drill in Lebanese waters. So this is very significant for Lebanon. It is the first time, and as we hear from Israeli media, that this is the first time that the Israelis actually succumb to certain demands from a single Arab state and accept its demands for Line 23, which was something that we saw 11 years ago as almost impossible.
Palestinian gunmen have killed an Israeli soldier in the occupied West Bank as tensions remain high there over the regime's deadly crackdown on Palestinians. Shooting took place near a settlement between Nablus and Jenin. The Israeli military says a search is underway to find the gunman who escaped in a car. A group that calls themselves the Den of Lions has claimed responsibility. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories. On Sunday, another Israeli soldier was killed following the regime's overnight raid in East Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movements have hailed the attacks, calling them a proper response to the regime's atrocities. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed by the regime forces in the West Bank since the start of this year. Earlier, we spoke to our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil. She told us about the operation that targeted the Israeli soldier.
What's happened is that a Palestinian vehicle stopped, and it's the men inside it, whether it's a man or a number of Palestinian men, opened fire at Israeli soldiers were stationing near the illegal settlement of Shavi Shamron, near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. An Israeli soldier was killed. The manhunt for this Palestinian vehicle and the men inside it are still ongoing. All the entrances to Nablus city had been completely closed. And we are speaking not only about Nablus city, but also the cities and towns northern the occupied West Bank are completely separated from the central of the occupied West Bank and southern of the occupied West Bank. Israeli soldiers are conducting a manhunt up till the moment.
Nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. In a joint statement, they called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. 292 rights groups say that Israel is currently holding around 4,700 Palestinian prisoners, including dozens of women, children, and people suffering from various illnesses. The statement reads, detainees are being subjected to arbitrary arrest and torture, which are both violations of international law. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians, urging the international community to pressure the regime into ending such imprisonment. The much-criticized policy allows Israel to imprison Palestinians indefinitely without charge or trial. Iran says it is against geopolitical changes in the region or any action to alter international borders. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment in a meeting with the visiting head of the Armenian Parliamentary Friendship Group in Tehran. He said that the Islamic Republic has a principled policy of respecting national sovereignty and territorial integrity of other countries. Amir Abdollahian was referring to a border dispute between Azerbaijan and Armenia. The top diplomat called for peaceful settlement of differences between Baku and Yerevan. Azerbaijan and Armenia have been engaged in deadly border clashes since May of 2021. The conflict further escalated in September this year, resulting in the deaths of hundreds of people from both sides. The U.S. says it is speeding up the shipment of air defense systems to Ukraine. The announcement comes after President Joe Biden reiterated Washington's support for Kiev. White House has approved sending Ukraine a total of 8 national advanced surface-to-air missile systems. 2 of the systems are expected to be delivered immediately. On Monday, Biden pledged to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to support the country's air defenses. U.S. has provided nearly $17 billion worth of security assistance since Russia began its offensive in late February. Officials in Moscow have time and again said that such shipments will only add fuel to the fire of war and prolong it. The European Union has announced new measures aimed at providing further support for Ukrainian refugees. This is while borders effectively remain closed to refugees from other parts of the world. Jerome Hughes has your report from Brussels.
The EU's Temporary Protection Directive has been specifically activated to help Ukrainian refugees. It means they are guaranteed housing, healthcare, education and welfare payments in any of the bloc's 27 member states.
I would like today to announce that the Temporary Protection Directive will continue to be in place at least until March 2024.
The European Commission has also launched a scheme to make it easier for millions of Ukrainians in the EU to find jobs. At the same time, thousands of refugees fleeing other conflict zones continue to sleep on the streets throughout the bloc. Also, as the cost of living crisis in the EU intensifies, activists say the bloc's own citizens are not receiving adequate support.
Nowadays we see that people can be homeless and have a work, have a job. There is in-work homelessness, but there is also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
As the war in Ukraine continues, the EU is pondering a 9th round of sanctions against Russia. Moscow's ally Belarus is also very likely to be targeted for cooperating with Russia.
All these steps, especially by the Belarusian regime, are against the will of the majority of the population and will be met with new and strong restrictive measures from the side of the European Union.
There have been renewed calls in the European Parliament for less focus on sanctions, less focus on arming Ukraine, and more focus on peace talks.
We need diplomats to finally take action. This is the view of 77% of all Germans. Political offers need to be made in order to encourage both sides to lay down their weapons.
According to many analysts, Western sanctions against Russia are clearly not working. Otherwise, a ninth package would not be on the agenda. In fact, economists say the current sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than had been anticipated. Inflation and interest rates continue to rise with no clear end in sight. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fears are mounting in the UK over a new wave of austerity as the government unveils details of its strategy to boost the country's economy. Leading think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, says Britain faces, quote, big and painful cuts in public spending to put the country's finances on a sustainable path. The IFS says reducing debt through spending cuts alone risks stretching out credibility to breaking point. Prime Minister Liz Truss has pledged to go ahead with a growth package after she was forced to drop a plan to cut taxes for the richest earners last month. Truss's intention has had the opposite effect, with the British pound crashing and the government's repayments on borrowing pushing up. Amina Taylor tells us more about the consequences of the austerity measures that the UK government has so far taken and those it just unveiled.
When the Institute for Fiscal Studies points to the fact that the British government will need to find 40 to 60 billion pounds to plug the shortfall, it's not going to come from the very wealthy. Again, it's going to be this further drive to carve out anything that's left in the public services. I mean, youth clubs, places around my neighborhood that were long thriving areas where young people could go or the elderly could hang out, all of those places have been cut. We're talking about almost ghost towns where they used to be thriving activities for those who were less well off. I'm not quite sure where the fat is left to be trimmed, quite frankly. We're already seeing a rundown of the National Health Service with record numbers of those still waiting for an operation. COVID pretty much decimated what was left in terms of, you know, waiting times and so on. Then you add that to what's inevitably going to be a cost of living crisis for the winter. I'm not quite sure where there's fat left to trim for this Chancellor. Where is he going to find more money to make more misery possible for the very poor? But unfortunately, the Tories have foam here. If there's more misery to be heaped on the poor, they will find a way to do that.
France's major trade union has threatened war against President Emmanuel Macron if his administration forces striking refinery staff back to work. Now, the warning from the General Confederation of Labor, or the CGT Union, comes after the government threatened to intervene to end the weeks-long walkout that has caused a fuel shortage throughout the country. Earlier, Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said the government will not allow the blockades on refineries to continue. He also threatened strikers with requisition measures if fuel depots were not soon reopened. Industrial action over pay has taken 60% of French refining capacity offline. Now, this has led to a shortage in a third of gas stations nationwide. Walkout has worsened the energy crisis and inflation, as France is already reeling from the impacts of the war in Ukraine.
The French leaders have seemingly found a solution to the country's energy crisis. Puffer jackets and turtlenecks have become the newest fashion trend in the Élysée, as ministers and the president try to imply a message to the public: wrap up warm for winter. That's while, as the cold season approaches, the nation struggles to afford heating. French motorists have been made to wait in long lines across the country to refuel their vehicles as petrol pumps run dry amid ongoing strikes at the country's oil refineries and storage sites. Almost a third of the petrol stations had problems getting deliveries of fuel as tanker drivers continue their strike over low wages and harsh working conditions amid a cost of living crisis in France. So, to cut the long story short, Macron is up to his neck in trouble, and his government's winter wardrobe messaging has drawn accusations of being out of touch with everyday reality. The country's far-right opposition leader, Marine Le Pen, mocked the government saying, "Don't have enough heating? Let them wear cashmere." And Gaspard Ganser, an advisor to former president François Hollande, labeled the idea grotesque and paternalistic. Paris has come up with an energy efficiency plan to get through the winter without blackouts. Homes and offices heated to a maximum of 19 Celsius degrees. No hot water in public buildings, no lit advertising overnight, a ban on doors left open in heated or air-conditioned shops, reduced temperatures in swimming pools and gyms. These are some examples of the action France is taking to save energy. However, environmentalists have accused the French government of promoting tiny measures while failing to take enough action on the climate crisis. They say unenforced and voluntary measures are ineffective. Also, scores of French intellectuals have urged the nation to rise in protest against President Emmanuel Macron's failure to improve economic conditions amid rising inflation. The current situation troubles the French government as a foretaste of problems to come, a potential winter of discontent. Now, the question is, will Macron get his head out of his turtleneck?
Tensions are escalating between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia after OPEC and other oil-producing countries announced an output cut. Washington says it is now reevaluating its relationship with Riyadh. White House National Security spokesman said that President Joe Biden is willing now to work with Congress on the future of Saudi ties. John Kirby says talks on the matter will start right away. Just earlier, Senator Bob Menendez called on the government to limit arms sales and military cooperation with the Saudis. Three legislators have already introduced a bill to withdraw troops and missile systems from the kingdom. Riyadh has, however, defended its decision for oil production cuts, saying that OPEC has a pivotal role in achieving balance and stability in global markets. And with that, we'll bring you to the end of this news bulletin, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The EU's silence toward the atrocities of the Zionist regime has made this bloc complicit in the Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Al Jazeera English wrote, "The very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels won't do much. In late June this year, the European Union announced that it would resume funding for two Palestinian NGOs, including Al-Haq and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. It had suspended financial support in May 2021 after the Zionist regime authorities supplied the European Commission with a dossier that claimed that six Palestinian NGOs, including Al-Haq, were funneling EU funds to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which the Zionist regime describes as a terrorist organization. A few months later, the Israeli regime war ministry extended that terrorist designation to these NGOs too. EU authorities have found no suspicions of irregularities and/or fraud. Still, on August 18th, Israeli regime forces raided the offices of seven Palestinian nonprofits in the occupied West Bank, be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, the raids, or the all-too-frequent military onslaughts on Gaza. The EU has done little to hold the Zionist regime accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. This is not a diplomatic lapse or misstep. It's important to understand that this impunity is guaranteed in the terms and conditions of EU-Israel relations, where political and economic relations are in no way contingent on the nature of the latter's conduct towards Palestinians. As a result, the Zionist regime can willfully violate Palestinian rights without fear of significant retribution from the EU, its biggest trade partner. The EU-Israel Association Agreement was ratified by EU member states' parliaments, the European Parliament and the Knesset, and entered into force in 2000 after decades of evidence of the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights. Following global outrage regarding the recent Israeli regime raids on the offices of Palestinian NGOs, Brussels decided to adopt a tougher tone. Joseph Borrell, the EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, said, "These actions are not acceptable." Yet even now, the EU's concern appears limited to words. In reality, the legal and political basis for EU-Israel relations does not allow for any recognition of Israel's role as a colonial occupier. The bloc of 27 nations has shown no desire to change that. The result? The EU is not an honest or effectual stakeholder in the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty and independence. On the contrary, its approach allows the Israeli regime to operate with complete impunity, human rights be damned. Electronic Intifada wrote that the European Union adores the Israeli regime should come as no surprise to anyone. But in the case anyone had doubts, the bloc's regional peace process envoy, Seven Koopmans, decided to make that clear in an op-ed for Haaretz this week. Almost every sentence oozes with praise and deference for the apartheid regime. Koopmans, of course, never uses the A word. As Israel's neighbor, historic friend, and largest trading partner, enjoying excellent cooperation in technology, education, and much more, we care, Koopmans says, adding, "Europeans understand Israel's security concerns. The EU strongly supports Israel's right to fight terrorism within full respect of its international human rights obligations," he said. That's a license for the fabricated regime of Israel to freely kill Palestinians, since the EU has never held the Israeli regime to any international human rights obligations. Meanwhile, Koopmans never acknowledges the right of Palestinians to resist occupation and colonization. Electronic Intifada said, Koopmans does acknowledge that Palestinians suffer, but he equates them with their oppressors and no longer holds the Israeli regime accountable for inflicting this suffering. It's apparently not the Zionist regime that keeps millions of Palestinians under occupation and without rights, but some mystical situation. Koopmans appears to be skirting around how much of the world, the Western world, being the latecomers, understand that Israel is a settler colonial regime that perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid. So what's the solution that Koopmans comes up with? Is it to demand the implementation of the countless UN resolutions that hold Israel in violent contempt of international law? Is it to impose costs on Israel for refusing to do so? Is it to defend and uphold the rights of all Palestinians, especially refugees, whom Israel bars from returning home solely because they are not Jews? In fact, Koopmans doesn't mention international law at all. Instead, he urges that those who are of goodwill need to work together to envisage a comprehensive peace, including Israelis, Palestinians, and in fact, the entire region. What he comes up with is the jargon of a management consultant or perhaps a self-help guru, saying, indeed, let us reverse engineer the solution. Rather than draw another roadmap, let's together start drafting the destination, even when essential parts of it can only be identified by Israelis and Palestinians, and probably only once they themselves have almost arrived, he claimed. The EU has, along with its masters in Washington, imposed unprecedented sanctions aimed, so far unsuccessfully, at crushing Russia's economy. And they are funneling fighters and billions of dollars of weapons to help Ukrainians fight. The double standard is very obvious even to those who work inside the halls of Brussels. Last month, Joseph Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief and Koopmans' boss admitted as much in an interview with El Pais, saying, resolving the situation of the people trapped in that open-air prison, that is Gaza, is not in the hands of the EU. It is a scandalous situation, a shame, but it is not in our hands to solve it. Borrell responded simultaneously acknowledging the horror the EU's Israeli friends subject Palestinians to, while at the same time absolving Europe of responsibility. As if a mere bystander, Borrell wrings his hands that the international community should find a solution for the crowded people without electricity, almost without drinking water. We are often criticized for having double standards, Borrell adds, but international politics is largely the administration of double standards. We do not face all problems with the same criteria, he said. If that's not bad enough, here is the punchline from this joke of a diplomat. There is no solution to the conflict in the Middle East without a very strong commitment on the part of the United States. Borrell is admitting that the EU can only follow orders from Washington and has no or is not willing to assert any freedom of action.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in a previous episode, you told us many elements, many things an educator and trainer, a parent should have for the upbringing of a child. You said there should be understanding of self, there should be understanding of competencies, there should be skills, there should be attitude. Would want you to throw some more light on the attitude?
Yes, as I said, the most important thing, of course, attitude is embedded in our knowledge.
Yeah.
The attitude which we have or we develop, one root is the knowledge the cognition we have of things.
Yeah.
The other then aspect goes into the emotions and the feelings which emanate from that knowledge and causes those actions and behavior, outward behavior, which is very important in any relationship, especially man and wife, and more so between parents and children.
Yeah.
So the attitude plays a bridging role
Between
the knowledge we have and the skills which have to be employed in that relationship.
You remind me of some lines wherein it says that, look at your thoughts, they become your words. Look at your words, they become your actions. Look at your actions, they become your habits. And look at your habits, it becomes your character.
Very good. Very good. That's exactly what we want to say. So our thoughts, our understanding, number one, apart from those elements that we were talking about, the most important thing is that as a person who is considered to be a true believer, a practicing believer, a mu'min, a salih person, a competent person, the most important feature is that it is for the sake of God. Everything is for the sake of God. Everything is within the bounds of Allah's rules and commands, with a purpose in mind for implementing the concept of Tawheed in society based on wilaya, the implementation of wilaya, as we mentioned before. Parents become a link between the family and the imamah, concept of imamah.
All right.
As they are the
guardians at home,
they are a part of the process of creativity that Allah Almighty has adopted for the creation of the universe and
True.
The human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They are part of that system.
Yeah.
They are within the system of causes and effects that lead to the creation of a human being in this world. So the parents play a role in the creation of the human being as a part of that system. They are not the creators themselves. They facilitate the
All
creation
right.
of a human being
yeah.
and of a child. And the system has been created by Allah Almighty because He is the supreme creator.
Yeah.
And then as they become a part of that system, they also become a part of the concept of wilaya, which has to be, as mentioned before, has to be imbibed in the child.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to have this understanding and this thought in their minds. And this has to change into their attitude, where they are able to bring up a child in this worldview.
Yeah.
And in this ideology.
Yeah.
And that is very important, because upbringing of a child, as I said, as a trust of Allah Almighty, a person who is going to become a part of the companions of the Imam, that is a very important thing. That's a mission which has to be undertaken with a great zeal.
And so, it does not happen just it does not happen in one night.
It doesn't happen. There's a lot of learning involved.
Yeah.
And even if, as I said, we have these things in our minds, we have a lot of things, but during the whole process, we need to learn.
Yeah. So we are always in the process of learning. We'll talk more on that after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqafi, and we are discussing parents as educators and what qualities they should have. Well, Professor Naqafi, you said that ultimate aim for now, like the current generation, is to create soldiers for Imam Zaman, Ajallah Ta'ala Faraja. You said that to create soldiers for him, to make an army for him, an army that is always in the state of ready, steady, and go. Now, you said that this does not happen in just one night. It has a lot of process, a lot of learning to go through. So we were focusing on attitude, the element of attitude. I would want to know more from you.
So when we talk about a person who has knowledge, he knows, he understands, he has that worldview. We have a very comprehensive worldview. We have a great deal of understanding about the universe, but that does not necessarily change into actions or behavior.
All right.
Until and unless the knowledge goes to a level where one has faith.
Okay.
In what he knows and what he believes.
All right.
And faith is at a higher level than knowledge.
All right.
Knowing is maybe believing, but it's not necessarily having faith.
All right. So for
example, faith is something which is much beyond that, which translates into actions by virtue of the taqwa it generates in our attitude.
All right. So we as parents should have this thing in our minds. Like, if I have a daughter and I only give her the knowledge of hijab, I don't do the things that it becomes her faith that she chooses it herself. Yeah, she's not going to practice it maybe.
Myself also, if I want to be able to educate my child properly, I also have to have the proper faith.
Yeah.
Knowledge, attitude, the faith. The faith has to translate into taqwa. Taqwa is where I should not only say that I believe and have faith in Allah Almighty, I accept His rules, but I am ready to implement them in my life. That's the realm of taqwa. When I become ready to just, you know, I'm on a springboard, ready to take off and dive.
Yeah.
That is where taqwa comes in.
Yeah.
Makes me take care of myself within the bounds of Allah Almighty, the boundaries He has made.
Yeah.
And then I'm ready to create that behavior which is necessary. And
required.
This is the same thing. Huh?
The required behavior.
The required behavior.
Yeah.
And this is how that behavior will be inculcated in my child also.
Exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Neka. We were discussing what elements educator parents need to be having as educators. Well, Professor Nakavi, you were saying.
Yes, I was saying knowledge, then faith, then taqwa. Then taqwa translates into action and behavior. And that is the stage where one becomes a person called muhsin, who has carried out good deeds in the best possible way. That is ihsan, that is muhsineen. Like we have muttaqeen and muhsineen.
Okay.
Are interrelated.
All right.
So taqwa leads to carrying out good actions, good deeds, amal salih, with ihsan. Ihsan is doing good deeds in the best possible way with excellence. And that requires proper skills.
Exactly. But don't you think many parents out there who maybe themselves, they are practicing Muslims, they have knowledge, they have everything. But when it comes to their children, they directly start with actions. While as you are saying that action comes at last. The first part is knowledge, and then how it becomes faith, and how it develops into taqwa, and then how your taqwa, you know, actually facilitates your actions. But many parents are out there who are directly working on actions. They don't educate their children. They don't give knowledge about that particular thing. They don't develop that faith regarding that particular thing.
Of course, it's in my analysis, when I analyze these concepts and bring about a relationship between them, this analysis comes forward. But when we are acting, all of these things are embedded within us, in our thoughts and in our feelings, and they should be there. So it's nothing wrong in going to the action stage, but with this background, of course, it's not going to lead to the proper results.
Yeah.
I have to be pretty sure that when I'm dealing with my child, then I am doing with a proper mindset, with a proper attitude, with the proper faith, the sincerity of purpose. It shouldn't be for my sake, my own self. It should be for the sake of Allah. It should be not that I want this child to grow up to take care of me.
Yeah.
I want him to grow up so he becomes a custodian of the heritage of the Islamic tradition.
Yeah.
Me, I'm not important. Yes, if he takes care of me, that's up to him. But I have to create a person, I have to train a person, I have to bring him up in such a way that he becomes a Muslim,
practicing Muslim.
A perfect Muslim.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. Well, dear listeners, nothing comes overnight. There's a lot of job to do, especially when it comes to our children. And in this program, we provide you all that. Thank you so much for being with us. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanillah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. A way of life, a way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
No doubt, Palestinians are the only owners of the land of Palestine, which is partly occupied by the fabricated regime of Israel. The Zionist regime, which is after ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, is now working to expel Palestinians from Masafer Yatah in the West Bank by making living conditions for its residents intolerable. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Electronic Intifada wrote, a prominent Israeli human rights group is calling on Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to urgently intervene to prevent the expulsion of Palestinians from a rural area of the West Bank. In a letter delivered recently, Betzlem requested Khan's urgent intervention to prevent the Zionist regime from continuing to carry out this policy, and to clarify that forcible transfer constitutes a war crime under the Rome Statute, the founding treaty of the International Criminal Court. The Zionist regime seeks to expel some 1,000 Palestinians from Masafer Yatah in the West Bank's South Al-Khalil Hills by making the conditions they live in so unbearable they are forced to leave the area they have lived in for generations, Betzlem states in his letter. While these efforts have been underway for decades, the Zionist regime has recently massively stepped them up in scope, severity, and frequency. Those efforts were accelerated after the Zionist regime's high court rejected a legal challenge to the plans to turn the area into the military training zone. One of the Israeli regime judges who issued the verdict is a settler who was born in the UK and lives in a Jewish-only colony in the West Bank built in violation of international law. Ariel Sharon, then Zionist regime's agriculture minister, admitted in 1981 that the area was declared a firing zone for the purpose of displacing Palestinians from their land so it may be seized by the Israeli regime. The High Court's ruling in May concluded two decades of challenges mounted by Palestinians in Masafer Yatah. Since 2006, The fabricated regime of Israel destroyed nearly 70 residential structures in these communities that were home to 355 people, 175 of them minors, according to Betzalem. The group has also documented the demolition of 32 non-residential structures in these communities. Violence by Jewish settlers also serves the regime's aim of pushing Palestinians off their land in Masafer Yatta. Betzalem states, Jewish settlers physically assault Palestinian shepherds and use their land, sabotage water sources and enter homes, among other violent acts, with full state backing and often active participation of Israeli soldiers and police. According to Betzalem, since the High Court ruling earlier this year, life for Palestinian residents has become a nightmare. The Zionist regime's aim, the rights group says, is to make Palestinian lives miserable enough. So they will leave their homes and land, and the state will take over the area. The Zionist regime has conducted military training exercises involving tanks and live fire in the area. The military has confiscated vehicles and imposed roadblocks hindering Palestinians in the rural area from accessing nearby population centers. Betzalem said soldiers at roadblocks make it difficult and often outright prevent access to humanitarian agencies, human rights organizations, activists, journalists, and diplomats. An intervention by Khan's predecessor, Fatou Bensouda, is believed to have discouraged the Zionist regime from destroying Khan al-Ahmar, a Bedouin community in the West Bank. Bensouda warned the Zionist regime in 2018 that the planned eviction of Khan al-Ahmar would constitute a war crime. Despite this warning, several lawmakers pledged to destroy the village while campaigning for votes during the Zionist regime's last general election. Before her term as ICC chief prosecutor ended last year, Bensouda opened a formal investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip amid fierce opposition and hostility from the Zionist regime and the U.S. Israel's settlement enterprise in the West Bank is likely a primary focus of the ICC investigation. The Israeli regime's officials responsible for executing policy in Masafer Yatta may be treated as suspects by the court, which tries individuals rather than states. According to Betzalem, those responsible include Israeli regime's prime minister, war minister, military chief of staff, and the high court judges who legally sanctioned the policy. Even though the ICC opened an investigation in Palestine last year, international justice remains an uphill battle. Palestinian human rights groups have expressed frustration that since the beginning of his term as chief prosecutor last June, Khan, Britain's nominee for the post, the ICC investigation in Palestine, hasn't moved forward. The chief prosecutor, who was nominated for his post by the UK, which also opposes the ICC investigation in Palestine, has made no public statement according to Israeli regime recently banning and raiding offices of Palestinian human rights groups that have submitted evidence files to the court on behalf of victims. During his visit to Al-Quds in July, U.S. President Joe Biden affirmed that Washington would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or International Criminal Court, Biden claimed. Also, the website of Palestine Chronicle wrote, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has called on the International Criminal Court ICC prosecutor Karim Khan to urgently intervene to stop Israel from evicting Palestinians from their homes and land in Masafer Yatam, the official Palestinian news agency Wafa reported. Israeli regime authorities are planning the eviction of some 1,000 Palestinian inhabitants of Masafer Yatam, a rural area located south of Al-Khalil in the occupied West Bank, in order to create a military firing zone for Israeli regime occupation forces. 8 villages, including 4 schools, clinics, and hundreds of other structures in the area, are slated for demolition. The fabricated regime of Israel has been trying to drive these communities out for decades, but has recently escalated its actions in scope, severity, and frequency following the May 2022 ruling by the Zionist regime Supreme Court. The ruling, which contravened international law provisions and basic moral principles, reached the conclusion that the residents have no right to live on the land and there is no legal impediment to expelling them. Israel has made the residents' lives a nightmare. They suffer daily threats by soldiers and settlers to their bodies and property, as well as noise and pollution hazards, routine damage to infrastructure, incessant invasion of their privacy and constant uncertainty over their future, said B'Tselem in a statement. The statement added, Israel is also working to cut these small communities off from their surroundings, with the military placing roadblocks, confiscating cars and hindering activists, journalists and diplomats from accessing the area.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.